Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. I hope you guys are doing great. Anything that might be helpful for us to talk about before we move into our last seminar and the discussion about something that I think we don't nearly talk about enough in coaching is how to deal with extreme success. I have some thoughts and experiences about this I want to share with you, and especially as we're talking about the whole experience of stress mastery and peak performance. But I want to respond to any questions or reflections or observations that any of you have. Remember that we're going to tack on just a bit of extra time at the end, at the top of the hour, so that we'll have a discussion. So have anything also ready that you'd like to discuss at that time. But anything for right now, any questions or observations or reflections any of you have? Well, let me ask a harder question. Did anybody do homework to apply from the neuroconditioning program going through the 7 steps of the roadmap system? Anybody try that to have an experience you want to share? Okay. One at a time, though. Any thoughts or questions any of you have about that or anything? What question should I be asking? Is there anything that stands out right now that you're taking away from the first 3 seminars that you hadn't anticipated or that stands out to you in any way? You guys better jump in. The questions get harder as we go into the evening here. So,
I'm just trying to check if I'm muted or not.
You are unmuted, finally.
Okay, perfect.
So lonely.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Dave, this is John Utter from Washington State. And,
yeah, hey, welcome.
Hey, thanks. One of the things I've taken away and really worked on and also passed on to my coaching clients is the kind of what I would call the 4-column trigger triage. I know you had a different title for it, but it's been really fun to work with that and just start documenting, you know, okay, what are the triggers? What's my common response? What's my, you know, what's my mantra and my physical kind of response to help me get out of that mind state? And then what's the ideal solution?
Great. Okay.
I had one client who I asked her, so what kind of body signal are you going to give yourself? And she goes, well, I'm going to shake my feet. And I thought that was awesome because it was helping her get unstuck from this kind of freeze reaction she'd get when she was going to apply for a job. So it's been helpful.
Okay, well, that's great. And I think once you have someone work with that enough, you'll see how it can be called truly a neural conditioning chart because it changes the neural association, the pathway in your brain, so that once you do it enough, the first thing that will become automatic is the cue will automatically induce the state that's grounded and centered to move into that ideal behavior. But once you go through all 4 columns in a horizontal way, what was initially an emotional trigger will now become coupled automatically with the default mode of that ideal behavior. And that's the
beauty
of once we continue doing something, our brain rewires to make it the default mode. And then you can see more quickly, and this may be more evident to some people on the front end, that very thin line between column 1 and column 2, the emotional trigger and the immediate response, whether it's behavioral, emotional, or all a bunch of things jumbled together, that's an instantaneous state change. And that state change can occur in the nanosecond of that trigger to induce the whole experience that's in that time capsule, and the time capsule won't change. And I think you mentioned something and alluded to it that I've been giving some thought to recently and have worked with some people about a performance cue. Think about how when somebody's in the flow of action, like pro athletes. Is Shelley on the line by any chance? Okay. Her son-in-law is George Kittle, the all-pro tight end. Before every play, he touches a Joker tattoo on his arm to get grounded and centered. I mentioned the all-pro cornerback who simply said reset. And remember, people do things in alignment with what their primary style is. Some people are auditory, some people kinesthetic, some people visual. So often in a flow of action, when it's episodic, like football, for example, it's not the flow of, say, a basketball or a soccer or actors, for example. You have to reset regularly. But think about the performance cue that somebody can do. I gave you the example of the woman in London. She simply touched her ring. That helped her get grounded and centered instantly. You know, look at the different kinds of performance rituals and cues. You know, the whole style of baggy shorts in the NBA. How did that happen, you may ask? Well, Michael Jordan wore his college shorts underneath his pro shorts every game that he ever played. So they developed longer shorts to cover that up so it wouldn't embarrass somebody. But it was a demand that he had. Remember Pete Maravich, who wore the same socks that he did all the way through high school, all the way through every game he played in the pros. They're all kind of superstitious, but also performance cues, and they kind of blend together in some instances. So thanks, John, for mentioning that. And it's a good reminder to develop your own style to get grounded and centered, like before you accept every call from every client or get on the phone to do a training. Whatever works for you, to really pay attention to that until it becomes so automatic that you don't even have to think about it.
Thanks, Dave.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Other thoughts or questions or anything else you'd like to touch on before we move into the material?
David, Marguerite.
Oh. Marguerite, go ahead. I heard you, and then we'll come back to who I didn't hear.
Okay, so this sort of fits under the automatic things I don't even realize I'm doing. I actually have set up different zones within my home, and they're all COVID-19 specific at this point. When I'm in my office, I work. When I'm on my yoga mat, which is in its own beautiful little space, I do my yoga or I meditate. When I go to my sewing machine, it's set up where I'm making masks to give to friends and family, etc. So as I need a break, I go and I sew a few masks, or I go on my yoga mat or whatever I do, or I go to the kitchen and I prepare a meal. So it's these are just different zones that help me to be in different states of mind.
I think that is so important, and that you've really conceptualized it and created it to have a framework that establishes a mindset that really supports your work, and within that mindset and that framework to not have any distractions that can interfere with that in any way. So I think that's a great example, and it's what I would suggest, and probably most of you have done already intuitively or in a planned way, of setting up a home office so that there's absolutely no intrusion whatsoever for attention and the flow of remaining sustained in the state of mind to be 100% immersed in the work with your clients. Okay, so the other reason Marguerite was farthest away from the pen in Canada. So who else said something at the same time I didn't hear?
Hi, Dave. It's Carlene from Edmonton.
Oh, okay. Okay, I may be wrong about farthest away from the thing. Go ahead, please.
So as you know, I teach yoga and meditation. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we talk about is how an emotional state translates to a physical location in the body. And now not everybody is connected enough to feel that, but it's something that over time you can connect to and feel more readily when you're more connected to your body. And so I guess I'm wondering, with the neuroconditioning chart in the first column with emotional trigger, would you also list as an emotional trigger physical sensations or not? Physical sensations as they would relate to the time capsule?
The simple answer is yes, and let me put that in a context. A state of mind is a psychophysiological state. So any state is going to have an entire software program of mind, body, spirit, of physical and mental and representational. So sometimes something can lead the way, like an alcoholic can hear a tinkling of a glass and think of a drink and boom, be triggered to want a drink. Or it can lead the way if you're in a, you know, to get a 2-minute mindfulness meditation. It means that you get centered and then everything else follows. So I think the awareness that you mentioned is about all the components and recognizing which component may be a trigger. Sometimes it may be a word, a gesture for somebody more visually oriented. It may be the raising of an eyebrow of a parent or somebody doing something like that, that boom, is an instant trigger. Sometimes it can be a sensation, as you mentioned, that can herald an entire shift to a different state. Sometimes it's auditory. So be aware, as you've mentioned, of what leads the way and then what follows, because the cause and effect is the emotional trigger of whatever nature leads to the state change, and the state change is all the content of that time capsule, and trying to focus on the content, which seems so logical because that's something that seems like you can change or regulate or avoid. But everything in that time capsule, all the emotion, all the negative self-talk, all of that, that's not going to change. You can't therapize or logic or work through or cathart your way out of it. It's going to stay the same. So you move to a different way of getting grounded, of staying present, instead of being in that time capsule that has its own age or its own age range.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just an elaborate agreement of what you're saying and expanding it to look at that in the picture of what you're describing. Does that make sense to you?
It does. Thank you.
Does that fit with your experience?
It does.
Okay.
I use different language.
Yeah, that's it. Okay.
When I did my transition
many years ago from practicing psychiatry and psychoanalysis, I worked with a mentor coach who also had made a transition from practicing full-time to being a master coach. One of the first things she did was help me clean up my language. We were talking about the same thing, but it had to be more experience near for coaching. So I think that's wise to really pay attention to that and translate whatever I'm saying into your language and the communication that you have with your clients. So I think that's wise.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I'm going to move us into lecture mode now and jot down any thoughts or questions or comments you have as we get to the end. Remember, we'll tack on the time to have a little bit more discussion at the end, at the top of the hour, and I may finish before then, so we'll have even longer. We're going to talk in our final seminar about extreme success challenges. I want to began with talking about people who have exceptional achievement and if overconfidence becomes a part of that and how that can compromise functioning. If you ask any player in a physician's basketball league whether he or she would compete with LeBron James, they'd laugh. Yet many of those same physicians willingly compete with billionaire investor Warren Buffett. I've been in some of those leagues. Cognitive biases and mental errors make them believe they can outperform successful full-time investment experts. Those who have achieved in exceptional ways create challenges for themselves in the very attainment of that success. Some highly successful people, from expert actors and athletes to practicing medical and legal experts, began to believe they can be good in other areas, such as investing. Even expertise in one area exceptionally does not equate with expertise in another. Warren Buffett recognized this. He said, "I don't think being able to allocate capital means you're good at anything else." Overconfidence, which is a state of mind also, creates a misperception of ability when it's informed by spectacular success in one area. University of Pennsylvania psychologists Philip Tetlock and Barbara Meller studied over 25,000 forecasts from people whose task was to anticipate how the future would unfold. Their studies, like a number of others, have revealed exceptional overconfidence in the judgment of doctors, lawyers, engineers, and even scientists in their decision-making process. The stimulation of overconfidence is biologically habituating. Look at the recent revelations of politicians, actors, and athletes who came to believe that their success made them immune to boundary violations. From Macbeth, we learn that we are most vulnerable not when we're beginning, not even when we're destitute or needy, but after the biggest triumphs of our lives. For Macbeth, the moment the witches came was after the most massive successes he had ever experienced of winning two battles and enjoying immense popularity. Just look at Elvis, Marilyn, Janice, F. Scott, Kurt, Belushi, Philip Seymour. Some people need mentor coaches not to become successful, but to help them regulate their states of mind to manage emotions and to sustain success. Complacency and overconfidence become equal challenges. Navigating extreme success creates unique challenges. Exceptional success transcends all usual and exceptional categories, such as the athlete who plays really well or defies the limits of physical aging. It also occurs when accomplishments or the resultant fame or wealth transcend any possible anticipation, any possible preparation or model of how to do it and what to do with it, or just simply engaging it. Keith Richards said, most simply, "Fame has killed more very talented guys than drugs." So let's look at one aspect of that, success anticlimax. After Bruce Jenner's last decathlon in Montreal, the next morning, he asked, "So what am I going to do now?" After a long practiced and anticipated success, people often have to deal with success anticlimax. The sprint system mediated by dopamine can sustain the excitement of expectation, of anticipating a consequence. As we know from various performers, this can last for years or even decades. This shift to the neurochemical marathon system designed to sustain and balance endeavors can read as a lack of excitement, as if something were missing, or even to feeling slightly depressed. Robert Louis Stevenson put this dynamic very simply, to travel hopefully is a better thing than to arrive. Before anybody knew about dopamine, he knew that hope, expectation, anticipation of the next step sustained excitement and sustained endeavors. That's the sprint system, even though the sprint may last for a long, long time. When you shift to a different system, the norepinephrine system, after you arrive, it reads as less than excitement. Think about how some of your clients may make that transition. They're excited about all the possibilities, about all the new stuff. Maybe at 2 or 3 months into the engagement, it's sort of like, you know, is this all there is? They settle in to the large, harder middle work of coaching, and it reads to them as less than exciting, and they say, well, you know, Maybe I'll just do this on my own for a while. I'm kind of at a plateau. So this is something to keep in mind, to anticipate that even as or before it's happening. The athletes and executives I've worked with and others I've interviewed have learned to contend with the anticlimax of shifting from stimulating anticipation to sustaining maintenance, and to dose anticipation all along in an effective way. I vividly recall my favorite athletic coach's first introduction to me of his version of this aspect of sports psychology. As a freshman, I was fortunate to make the traveling squad of 12 players in basketball, even though I felt really intimidated by the upperclassmen surrounding me most of the time. Just after we won our first tournament and boarded our bus, Coach stood at the front of the bus and looked at each of us. We were all feeling really good about the big win, eager to get home and celebrate with the parade downtown. He said, "So, we won this tournament. This is not the biggest or the most prestigious tournament that we'll play this year. It's kind of a podunk tournament." And he paused. He said, "How many of you can really say you're proud to win this tournament?" Well, under any circumstance, I'd have raised my hand, as I suspected my teammates would, but nobody dared venture a single finger in the air. He concluded, "Feel good for now, but let's get home and really start working on being an excellent team." Coach knew somehow how to handle success anticlimax from his playing years, I'm sure. His life-changing coaching and the mentoring of me for 4 years in 3 sports resulted in many wins, a state championship, all-state basketball honors, but most importantly, my resultant 2 careers of helping others succeed. I'm on the second one now as we're talking. For any physical or intellectual achievement, the emotional role and creative closure have to be addressed upon a successful completion. I've known a number of authors, for example, who describe a letdown after completion of their book. One even, and this was a guy, described it as a postpartum depression. The most successful achievers have evolved their capacities to recover faster from success and anticlimax changes. So let's look at high-risk, high-stakes decisions. First, and you guys know the answer to this, does proven evidence change beliefs? Facts and beliefs are anatomical realities in our brains. You don't create a change by suddenly introducing a new idea and expect it to overwrite the one that's already there. And many of you have heard me say, if information was enough, we'd all exercise every day, eat mostly vegetables, be thin, have a lot of money saved up for the future, and a lot of librarians would be billionaires. But facts and logic are not powerful tools to alter opinions. Data is not a way to change minds. It's simply not how we decide. Established beliefs are extremely resistant to change because they're an anatomical reality, part of one's identity, even when scientific evidence disproves those beliefs. People regard valid information as evidence when it reinforces their already existing views. This is how arguments more staunchly solidify an original position. Presenting someone with information that contradicts an opinion that they have most likely causes that person to generate new counterarguments to further strengthen their view. People look for what validates their already existing position because it's part of their identity. And this is the boomerang effect, when it more staunchly creates counterarguments rather than gives new information to consider other possibilities. So as a result, people grow more confident in their initial convictions and use information to polarize opinions in this boomerang effect, like abortion, gun control, climate change, to name a few. And think about how once you've decided that this person in political office is either a good guy or a bad guy or woman, everything that happens then becomes a validation for your opinion. You've gathered information, you become blind to information that contradicts, or it just fits into your system. So let's look at how this happens in business and look at specifically success traps in business. The success trap in business is an almost ubiquitous phenomenon in which a company must shift the way it operates in order to survive. The canal boat companies of the 1700s didn't become the railroad companies of the 1800s. They stuck to their box. And in the 1900s, there were no Union Pacific Airlines. They stuck to their box. Good to gone. Motorola stuck to their story and slid from a premier electronics firm to a troubled industry. Meanwhile, Nokia at the time asked and listened to children and young people just developing their stories and used their feedback to become world-class. Good to great. Another example is Kodak, who stuck to analog photography, did not evolve to digital. More recently, Andy Grove at Intel described the success trap as being a time in an organization's life, and think about this parallel in terms of your professional position right now as you listen to this and your professional work. The time in an organization's life when the leaders have to think differently and have to move away from the organizational rigidity of developing and refining what's already successfully in place to think creatively of what can be. Grove said, miss the moment and you start to decline. He noted the difficulty at Intel to move from memory chips to embrace the next technology of microprocessing in order to sustain the viability of the entire company. And that was at a time that memory chips made Microsoft world class. World class. Successful performance for an individual or company can sustain focus on what created the success rather than looking to the next possible success. The new success becomes the old success if there's not a new model to step into or to evolve to. Attention to execution of the current success may miss the innovation needed to take the new steps forward. So a balance of refining and sustaining what's working combined with creative exploration of what's possible can be a delicate yet a dynamic balance. This is deliberate practice applied to a system of a team or a business. Brain scans of 63 seasoned business decision makers showed two things. Moving to new territory of exploratory strategies disengages from the pleasing routine of certainty. To leave the default mode to attend to new possibilities is uncomfortable and it takes more energy. Yet at the same time, creative innovation stimulates brain circuitry of anticipation and reward. So let's look for just a bit at some performance-related biases and their remedies. And think about how this may be applicable, if any are, to your situation, to your coaching business. There are some specific biases that are often created or exaggerated by success and have then a unique impact on performance. Awareness of the tendency of these biases to psychologically influence decisions and dilute optimum performance becomes really important to recognize, in my view. One is self-deception, and I think the details are in your outline, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on each of these, but I've listed, I'm pretty sure this is in your outline, deceptions that have been distilled from a number of studies, self-inflation, especially at times of significant success. 94% of people place themselves at the top half of their profession. 70% of drivers believe they're better than average. 75% of people consider themselves healthier than average. You can see how this bias of self-deception could prevent someone from going all in for a growth mindset and improvement. Self-deception can also show as a derogation of others, the shadow story of self-inflation. And this may be like when an image has been tarnished, or a need to align with an in-group and degrade the outgoing. We see this a lot in politics. Or a simple example is to align with the powerful, like the Stockholm syndrome, identification with the aggressor. And another, moral superiority. And this is so simple because the referees are always right when they call a foul on the visiting team. And one of the worst things they can do, one of the worst mistakes they can make, is to call a foul on my favorite Houston Rocket. But if I moved to Dallas, it would instantly become my favorite Maverick, and the Rockets would be out of favor. Another is the illusion of control. When we feel a lack of control, it enhances our tendency to see meaningful patterns in otherwise random data. Meaning, if we lack a sense of control, that's the most basic desire that we have as humans that gets activated, to feel effective. So we want to feel effective in something. We'll at least infer a cause and effect, even if it may not naturally exist. Another kind of bias, invincibility bias. Some common examples. Think about adolescents who don't estimate danger well, exaggerate performance and do risky behavior. Heavy smokers underestimate their cancer risk despite objective awareness. Skiers ignore warning signs and enter restricted areas to ski dangerous terrain, sometimes to their peril. Or somebody sees a roulette wheel stop on red 6 times and believe the chances are somehow different than 50-50, it'll stop on black the next spin. Another, optimism bias. Optimism bias is our tendency to underestimate the possibility of bad events in our lives, to overestimate the possibility of good events. We underestimate, for example, the likelihood of a car accident, of having cancer, overestimate our life expectancy, maybe, or future income. Newlyweds estimate the likelihood of divorce at 0%, while statistically 40% will end in divorce. Hindsight bias. Knowing how things turned out can influence the way we remember and even reframe past events. This is a good example in Nassim Taleb's Black Swan event. That's come to be a kind of standard icon now, that things are described as, maybe even the current epidemic has been described in some quarters as a black swan. And there are other biases. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but subjectivity bias. We have an ability to spot thinking and systematic errors in others, but may not look as objectively to assess our own. Present bias. We put great value in the present so much that it may take a massive future reward to forego the immediate pleasure of the present maybe to invest in the future, because the future is both a theory and an abstraction, so it competes poorly with the immediate reward of the pleasure chemical of dopamine. And here's an example of that. I'm going to start next Monday at this time with a four-part teleseminar series from CTA on coaching money mastery. The simple example that started a whole bunch of studies, Emily Pronin at Princeton found that people who have can conjure an image of their future selves, of what they will look like and feel and experience at like 70 or 80, have three times as much savings put away as people who can't quite picture themselves. Stanford followed this up and has age progression studies, computer-assisted age progression for if you continue smoking or not, if you gain a pound a year or not, you know, looking at your future self, and it affects every dimension where somebody can see their future selves, and they're finding the same things, that it affects future savings by about three times for people who actually see their future self because they have something in the future to see, to identify with. So let's look at bias remedies. A bias means that we not only ignore certain data, but we specifically ignore disconfirming data. Facts contrary to beliefs and self-images are rarely dismissed or just not engaged. We don't pay attention to it. A cue for a bias can simply be an anchor for booting up a particular mindset. It can be race, gender, weight, any number of other things that are automatically and largely unconsciously attributed. Then natural gravitation occurs to others who share the same mindset to engage in groupthink to further the notions and find evidence to confirm them. Groupthink can simply be shared blind spots. We ignore contrary evidence and share a self-deception often. We work diligently to preserve our opinions even though we may not consciously know exactly what they are. So the challenge then is to recognize, own, and assess certain aspects of our own story. These are the first three steps of the roadmap system. Recognize, own, and assess. The primary reasons it's a challenge. New information may cause unpleasant feelings. It may require a shift of belief. We tend to seek information that confirms our belief rather than disproves them. And the new information may require us to take actions that we don't really want to do. For example, to leave the security of our own stories and the certainty and predictability of how it will turn out may feel like a lack of control. We're motivated to avoid new information, especially if we expect bad news. Seeking a consultation with a doctor about certain symptoms confronts denial and the pain of undergoing testing. It's also more difficult when the information is hard to understand or interpret. It's difficult to realize what we don't know. So how do you come to know what you don't know? Candid, open feedback from trusted others becomes one way. In executive coaching, I've used a 360 assessment to have people immediately in the circle do an assessment of the person in focus. This challenge is a comfort zone, but provides objective, valuable information. For yourself, the roadmap is another way to deconstruct the components of a story and to look at understanding the algorithms of how you construct it to decide what exactly you want to change. So let's talk for just a minute about the hubris syndrome. Confidence is a state of mind that generates remarkable productivity, but overconfidence can become a slayer of success. While our minds constantly learn from challenges, internally and externally, the creative and empathic process can be derailed by, among other things, the blossoming of overconfidence. And it can result in risky behavior, risky investments. Let me give you an example. In one study, CEOs became more confident as they gained merger and acquisition experiences, resulting in their overvaluation of subsequent deals they were involved in. In research from the University of Vienna, investors who obtained significant experience with their market became overconfident and had risky asset trades. So overconfidence and the brain's potentiation of stimulation, wanting to keep the same stimulation going, enhances with sustained success and power. Blind certainty can replace active self-reflection. This is one of the reasons that it takes such a powerful grounding and centering to sustain remarkable success, because someone has to even more regulate internally their position. And if any of you have worked with people who have extreme something, extreme wealth, extreme fame, extreme power, everybody wants a piece of you. And everybody wants you to do something, and there's so much influence and so much possibility and temptation, you have to be even more grounded and centered and certain and clear of your identity. One of the best predictors of overconfidence is power, which enhances with time and experience and can result in stopping to question alternate possibilities. Because it's hard to, you know, it's hard to abandon the stimulation that you can become habituated to at a brain level of this constant firing of dopamine. Another thing, and this all sort of relates, but you have to kind of hang loose to these are all things I want to be sure and mention as part of this series. Another is talent. A growth mindset recognizes talents that can be enhanced through dedication and deliberate practice. A fixed mindset sees talents as either present or not present, not things to be developed. A fixed mindset, let me give you an example here. Edwin Moses, winner of 107 consecutive races and 4 world records, said, "I ran against a lot of individuals who were probably more physically talented." That's a growth mindset. That's recognizing that talent is not a determinant of success. And that has been shown in research more than just the last few years, over the last decade and a half. We now know from a number of perspectives that talent is not a genetic gift, but a developmental process. It can be enhanced when it's recognized, focused on, and nurtured by parents, teachers, coaches, mentors. Discipline and deliberate practice, that's the science and the neuroscience of practicing. Evolve both intellectual and physical talent. The social setting and enhancing framework contribute to both motivation and the maturation and development of talent. To recognize an advanced sports talent, for example, in a socially prominent area is fairly easy. Baseball and basketball in the U.S., soccer in England, ice hockey in Canada. Sports make it easy because they're so visible, they're so identifiable and measurable. Some basic talent in other areas may not be as easily recognized or visible to develop, not even transparent. Talent in art, verbal ability, physical and mental skills become challenges to identify and to facilitate. While there are different innate physical and mental capacities, just as individual personality and learning styles, the developmental process must be systematically nurtured by discipline and practice. The optimum model evolved from a number of studies about the development of expertise includes 3 aspects. and this is from the beginning, early diversification, so that you don't get locked into one thing only, only doing math or only, you know, playing tennis. Sampling a number of activities and exposure for both informed choices and long-term involvement. Deliberate play, for example, of experiencing sport through fun and playful games builds a solid foundation of intrinsic motivation. Deliberate play establishes a range of cognitive and motor experiences to develop expertise and self-management, as well as a foundation of generalizable skills. Only later, experts suggest, maybe as early as age 13, should any specialization begin to occur. And only by late adolescence have children developed physical, social, cognitive, emotional, and motor skills needed to specialize in one sport or one endeavor. I've worked before as an analyst with a couple of child prodigies who began one at age 4 and one at age 5 exclusively focusing on a particular skill, and was doing, you know, world stage concerts before hitting double digits. And they were, both of them were absolutely lost about how to do usual things in late adolescence, and particularly this exquisite skill of being an adult. They hadn't figured out, you know, how to talk to the opposite sex or do some basic skills, because they had exclusively focused on their child prodigy focus. So a composite of studies of elite performers across a number of fields has found some common traits that characterize their development and experience. And these are things that are a result of a systematic approach to deliberate practice. Managing anxiety and pressure situations, confidence, mental toughness and resilience, the ability to focus and block all distractions, huge, a hard work ethic, the practice of setting and achieving goals, being coachable, and optimism. There are a number of studies on each of these. This is just a highly refined summary, just of an overview. So here's one of a couple of things I want to touch on before we wrap up and have discussion. One is the disadvantage of talent. The talent myth assumes a fixed mindset. Why spend time and energy trying to improve if success only comes to people with the right talent or the right genes? That skill and intelligence can be improved, however, is a growth mindset. Talent can be a potential disadvantage, as someone with a natural talent may not, at the very beginning of skill development, subject themselves to the same hard work, rigors, and dedication as someone without those abilities. Natural talent can suffice for a period of time, but if it replaces the discipline and dedication to practice and developing the whole scope of abilities, even the things you don't like to practice that you're not good at, if you keep doing the forehand because you're great at it and don't really practice, you know, the dink shot, you're going to be screwed when competition happens and you need a dink shot. Those with less skills have to work harder to develop them and may establish a systematic way to grow and improve in the process. That's why one of the tenets of deliberate practice is you always practice just at the edge of your comfort zone, always taking on another step of what's not quite comfortable yet in moving ahead. Without relying totally on a natural athletic or intellectual capacity, they persevere through adversity to hone a foundation of repeatable strategies and skill development rather than falling back on just doing what they're most talented at or what they're first good at. A shadow story of talent is that it can mask, this is something to think about. A shadow story of talent is that it can mask poor teaching or coaching for a significant period of time or even until it's time to play a bigger game in a more challenging way, intellectually or physically. And a final note on sustainable success. After their first unprecedentedly successful whirlwind tour of the United States, the first thing the Beatles did when they got back to England was to go to the studio and make the next album. And they made a new album regularly every 6 months. They didn't bask in their glory or let it derail their plans. They consolidated the success to integrate it with ongoing focus and plans. They pressed their advantage but did not let success derail their plans or hijack their focus. And this is in response to a couple of questions about case examples. Here's a case example. A client I'll call Evelyn consulted me because she was having burnout in her career. She had enjoyed remarkable and rapid success as an actress, moving quickly through local theater productions, national commercials, and a role in a nationally syndicated series. Her energy brightened a room. It sort of induced optimism in others. People loved to be around her. They were impressed with her imaginative and creative presence. I could understand that totally. Being highly intuitive and sensitive allowed her attunement and connection to others as well as to the character she played. She would totally immerse herself in the character. With this sensitivity came the resonance with stressful emotions from those around her, resulting in sensitivity to family and friends, especially by fans who would approach her at restaurants and public areas, wanting her autograph or a selfie with her. She wanted to please them. She enjoyed the popularity, but felt depleted after these experiences. And she questioned whether the burnout in her career meant that she was not suited for what she was doing, even though she enjoyed everything about it, especially the immersion in the performances and the stardom, and seemed passionate about developing her craft, which is what we looked at initially in work. We explored her state of mind after these experiences. She described how she had to go home because she was depleted. This was not production, because she knew how to recover from that. We had worked on that, but this was something she had introduced, that after, like, she could go to a restaurant. She learned some time ago she could never go to a mall, but just to a quiet restaurant. And she would come home depleted because she would feel drained. Even a nap wouldn't restore her energy. Her high degree of creativity and imagination was a natural for her expert work, but she didn't have the buffers and boundaries in place to regulate her state of mind in her private time, and that resulted in some real depletion. She was reading that as burnout. She needed to develop an internal point of reference even more than most individuals, as her intuitive empathic style, it's at times selfless, was eroding the joy from her accomplishments. We focused on her desire to resonate with and nurture others that needed to be developed within herself first, to not abandon herself, to remain grounded in her own experience, and to create a systematic way to do that. She then developed a way to carve out her private space and a time devoted to her needs, and have specific boundaries in her interface with others. These pragmatic strategies allowed her to preserve her energy and to deploy it by conscious and specific choice rather than in a reactive mode, in other words, responding to someone else. For example, she developed an awareness of how the character that she inhabited for a screen role was itself a state of mind, and how to effectively enter and exit that state of mind each day so that she could preserve her own private space and not intermingle the two. If we have time, I'll talk a little bit about what she created to close the story of that day. She learned to dose time and titrate her exposure to others, reduce the excessive stimulation of crowds, especially of needy or negative people. And this was framed necessarily as self-care, not labeling it as no to fans meant guilt, but no simply means this is where you end and I began. I have my needs now. I have to take care of me in order to continue to pursue my craft. She built in quiet time to emotionally decompress and recharge. She learned the value of meditation, of calming mini breaks through the day, to do 1 to 2 minute mindfulness meditations as a response to signals that might have otherwise triggered a default mode of reactivity. By protecting herself in this way and being attuned to the necessary boundaries between herself and others, she maintained her valued sensitivity and empathic resonance now with herself as well as others, without absorbing the impact of the feeling of others. She became not as nearly vulnerable to others to learn how to create those boundaries. Being a very visual person, her mantra included a visual focus rather than a word phrase. She envisioned being enveloped in a cone of white, warm light around her entire body that offered energy as well as protection. It blocked any negativity as well as restored her own energy and internal point of reference. These necessary steps to stay centered in an otherwise very demanding world of fame proved invaluable for her to sustain her energy and to continue to contribute in ways that she valued. And I mention this as an extreme, but every one of your clients has some variation of this. The executive, the business person, the parent will need to find ways to be attuned to and self-regulate in order to take care of themselves first, in order to maintain the energy to do it for others, but they're always establishing a model for their children, their employees, their colleagues. Everybody's taking unconscious notes at the same time you're talking about something else. By more effectively grounding and centering herself, my client, and cultivating mindfulness, she developed a greater resilience to the influence and emotion of others. She recognized how to automatically put the needs of others before her own, how to not automatically do that. And the result was her career soared even higher, and she needed these skills even more so. Now, I've ended the outline with the a list of contrasting amateurs to experts. I started doing it with experts and professionals, but I think amateur and the expert. And the application of these principles of stress mastery and peak performance can apply to all areas, everything we've talked about now, to all areas of business, education, arts, health, human relationships, and sports. As we become more self-reflective and better learners, we more effectively write our own stories, whether life, career, wellness, relationship, money, or any others. Each are contributions to ourselves. So we're in discussion mode now. I want to say, if you'll manage background noise, star six, it's not about to talk. I want to say before anybody has to peel off, it's been a real privilege to work with you for these four seminars. It's been fun to get together and hone some ideas and some specific responses in my attempt to wrap in the questions and the hopes that each of you have had. I hope I've done that to some degree, and that shaped some of my comments and illustrations. So thank you for all of that. I appreciate it. Let's talk about what you'd like to talk about now. Questions, thoughts, comments. I'm interested first because I'm developing this into a whole other area of training and that sort of thing. What's the thing that you are most struck by or that seems most important to you that you're taking away? And then I want some suggestions of things to add or do differently. But what's the most important thing that you're taking away? Anybody? Just in a succinct overview.
Hey, Dave, this is Rob Killen.
Hey, Rob, how are you? Go ahead.
Hey, I'm great, thanks. I think for myself, the biggest thing I take away is just the importance of mindset as it relates to people who are successful in whatever endeavors they apply themselves in, whether it's sports, relationships, careers. It's so powerful, and you've shown that well throughout the past few weeks here.
Well, thanks. And at the other end, people who it's also very, very important to are people who are not successful, because it's a way to move in that continuum, and in an informed way to really do the kind of things that can generate success. You know, I began by saying, and I reiterated a number of times, if you want to change, if you want to change a habit, focus on the system, not just the goal. So this is what we've been focusing on. The neuroconditioning program is a microsystem of an emotional trigger of the moment and regulating and self-awareness of that. The roadmap system is a macro system of really understanding your story and finding a way, having a way to deconstruct that and look at it to see what you want to change and how you want to go about it. So thanks, Rob, very much. Others?
Rob, I'm sorry, not Rob. Sorry. Dave, hi, Carolyn. I want to ask for two things. One, I wanted to say, to piggyback on I think it's Rob, the last speaker.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with your response, which is this whole framing of your mindset is really important for anyone. So it doesn't matter whether you're an expert, but just the ability to manage and regulate your behaviors and become mindful of your behavior is in and of itself pretty powerful stuff. What I would enjoy, because you mentioned that you're going to try to package this, is I'd love to be able to have you as part of a package that you put together, more actual activities that when working with groups that you could engage them in. I saw the ones that you have online and they're great, but I'm hoping that you're planning to sort of build the package very similar to the money management packet that you sent as part of that
yes,
program.
I am. You read my mind, partly because I planted some seeds probably. I'm looking at developing this into a training program. The Neuro Mentor Peak Performance Institute is one that I have begun and will develop a training program with a whole companion series of exercises as a separate document that can be just like the New Life Story Wellness Training has the client workbook and the New Money Story Mentor Training has the client workbook. This will have a separate workbook for use with clients that can be co-branded. I'm not nearly there yet, but I think that's really important because the practical how-to and how do we help clients do this, because it can supplement what we do in talking with somebody, and especially if you do something like groups to have, you know, the coaching groups that I have done have been all by telephone. Now, some of you may have heard the CTA thing that I did this last Saturday. It'll be, I think, refined and put out to everybody. You know, I was made for this crisis. You know, I work remotely, you know, telephone and online, and I get to wear cargo shorts all day long. So this is the kind of thing that can be useful for working with people in groups, for example, which I've done all by telephone, to have some exercises or work tools for each group meeting. And then the group may or may not talk about that, but it's useful because it kind of helps guides and directs their own deconstruction of it so that not everything, you know, how do you know exactly what to talk about? Because you don't exactly know what's important. Now, we do that as mentor coaches in collaboration, but it can be helpful to supplement and jumpstart that a lot. So thank you for mentioning that. I appreciate it.
Great. And just the last quick question. Can I get the appreciative skills inventory? Is that something that's free online, or is that not
appreciative
skills? Free?
I have no idea what that refers to.
Because you referred to it as part of this training, an appreciative skills inventory. I'll go back through my notes, but
okay.
So you mentioned that and you cited that.
I know what you're talking about. The whole body of work called appreciative inquiry.
That's inquiry.
Dr. Diana Whitney really initiated that. And Dr. David Copperwriter has done a great deal of work in that. It's its own body of work. And that's something I think is very useful. I don't hear it mentioned about coaching, but, I mean, that began coaching before coaching was coaching. So you ask in the direction of what you want to co-create. And basically we know from coaching that people will commit to what they help create. So that's why we ask at the beginning, you know, what would you like to talk about? You know, and we do it in a collaborative way. We're the only profession that has a framework of collaboration. Every other profession has a framework of consultancy, of being an expert and giving answers. And giving answers doesn't really work that well. I mean, we know from appreciative inquiry that, you know, asking a question has much greater impact than giving answers. So, yeah, thanks for mentioning that. And that's not something I generated, but it's certainly available and something I would recommend, yeah.
Okay.
There was another question. Actually, I didn't come back to the question that someone else asked at the beginning with Marguerite. I want to do that now. There was someone else who began a question on the front end at the same time as Marguerite. Did we get to that, and was that Colleen, or was there another question that I hadn't heard? Let me just say it simply. Who's next?
Hi, I'm Sansa Newton.
I really
enjoyed your seminar, and I am very brand new to being a life coach. So going over this was something I never even thought of thinking about as somebody that already had success. You assume that once they get the success that they don't need help anymore. But this shows that, yeah, you do. You do need help. And I would have never thought of that if it weren't for the seminar.
Great. Okay. Thank you for that. That's very interesting and very helpful. Yeah, in coaching, state always comes first, then strategy and story, because state boots up a particular mindset that then determines meaning and then behavior. So state always comes first. And that's why it's important, because it boots up the particular software program you use. And there's a lot of difference between, you know, Excel and Word.
Mm-hmm. It really made a lot of sense.
Well, good. Yeah, thank you for your feedback. Others, questions, thoughts?
Hey, this is Rob Myers.
Yeah, hey, go ahead.
Hey, how long are the recordings going to be available from the seminar that we've had for the last 4 weeks?
Typically for 30 days after the last seminar, so for the next month.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You bet. Yeah, and you can, they're there, and this one will be posted tomorrow, and you can, fast forward or listen to a certain segment if there's something that didn't quite make sense. There's a possibility it won't make sense the second time, but you can do that and not have to go through the whole thing. Questions, things that might be helpful still to talk about?
One last question, Dave. This is Carolyn again. I just want to get your opinion on this. So I have a potential client who contacted me and asked if they could fly me out to LA to conduct a training for employees. Now, typically I do training with individuals, so this would be my first group training if I undertake it. Do you, I mean, is it all right to go in person to actually do the training? Is that something I should consider, or would you recommend not?
From what perspective are you speaking at? You're talking about in person in this day of coronavirus? Are you talking about can you apply the training to the group? Do you do it in person or online? Or help me.
I'm sorry. Well, this predates the corona experience.
Okay.
Because actually, but just by about 2 weeks before it became a crisis.
Okay.
Or listed by the media as a pandemic. But we've been in contact. And so in lieu of that, so of course they stopped all travel, the company did.
Okay.
But in lieu of that.
In one sentence, what is your consultation question for us to discuss?
Should I show up in person, which was what I mentioned at the beginning.
So
is that
what are you going to show up in person for? What is your training?
Just to conduct a training with employees at 10 of their facilities.
Okay, how are you going to know what to train?
Well, I'm not going to know what to train until I have a chance to do, which is why I asked about the appreciative inquiry.
Well, yeah, you are if you listen to me, okay? No, this is to everybody, okay? That's a good question. I think there's, again, the model for training or facilitation, and those are slightly different, is different from individual work or group work with clients or just information segments. If you do a consult, and this is a whole different conversation, but I'll just give you a couple of highlights. If an organization asks you to do a consultation or a training with them, I would first meet to want to know what their primary challenge is. Same question you'd ask.
Yes.
What are the primary challenges? What do you have in place to address that, and what's missing and what's needed? So you have an idea then from this information gathering about what you want to do and what kind of proposal you want to submit. And you have an idea about the scope and the nature of it. And then after you do this meeting, and this doesn't have to be in person, you can submit a proposal, a one-page proposal that outlines three different parts. One is your understanding of what they want. Secondly, how you'll do that and the follow-up. Remember, you don't want a shipboard romance where, you know, you end and there's no more contact. You want to be sure that it becomes a process. And the third is the compensation for the scope of what you see as ideal. So that means that you've converted their request into some information that you can incorporate into a proposal and to have the proposal to them within days of having met with them. But you don't do it at the time or just reactively, but you want to think about it. You want to develop and see what material and resources, what's involved, and look at, you know, an ideal proposal. Does that answer your question at all?
Well, actually, yes, it does answer my question, but that was my entire approach, which is, well, I can't really give you, they asked me to get how much would I charge, and I said, well, I really can't respond to that because I have to first understand what the problems are, you know, change that, not problems, but what the challenges are as you see them or as your managers see them. So initially, they were going to have me go to each of the regional managers. I'm going to propose that I can do that as part of my fact finding, which I'm not planning to charge a fee for that, to just kind of get some feedback from each of the regional managers about how they perceive, you know, the successes and challenges of the organization and then put something together. That was my intent.
Well, one possibility is to have all of them together and to see what kind of group process is involved, since you'll be training them all together instead of one by one or group by group, and see what they come up with. You'll have information about the challenges and the process as well. And I would say from the beginning, frame it in a positive way instead of what you can't do is, you know, it sounds like an interesting opportunity and challenge. I would like to find more information about the specific challenges and the major benefits that you'd like to get. I can do this best by blank. And then you're providing a framework because you're the expert. You know, you come in, you're the expert. So how the information is gathered, you know, when you go in to see a doc, you don't start taking over and telling the doc questions to ask, or, you know, the doc is in charge and asks you the questions, and you put it into your own words. But then the process is determined by the professional. You're the professional. You know what's going to work and what's not, or you're going to determine that. So be in charge from the beginning and get your information in the very best way possible. That, you know, if you're not paid to go around to 10 different people and interview them, you're putting in a lot of work, I think, that will get you segmented information. And
I see.
You're not paid for it. So any other questions about this material?
Thank you for coaching me. Thank you for that.
Okay, you bet. Anything else from anybody? Any additions, thoughts, end comments from anybody? We're going to have to stop in just a minute. Well, thank you again. It's been a privilege. I'll be eager to, if you have any other thoughts and follow-up about applying this or looking at various aspects of it, let me know. I'll be interested in what you're doing with it and what you see, and I appreciate the feedback. It's been a privilege to work with you, and thank you again for all the very thoughtful comments, questions at the beginning, and interactions. It's been very, very stimulating. So thank you. And I'll be eager to hear what you guys are up to. See you now. Bye.
Thank you, Dave, so much.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
See you guys.
Good night.